Welcome to another episode of The Watchdog. It's me, Loki, here on Mimpress for another humdinger of an episode. As you know, we are the platform that watches the watchers. We put a lot of effort and research into our work. So because of that, we hope that you can support us by liking, sharing, subscribing, and just generally enjoying this video as much as you can. We're joined this week by the irresistible Alan McLeod, who has been publishing his findings on Mint Press for quite a while now. He's the same Alan McLeod that we know and love, so we are very happy to have him here. In breaking news, Boris Johnson has pulled out of the leadership race for the Conservative Party. He was hoping to return as Prime Minister. It did not seem to be something that had adequate support within the party, so he has withdrawn, paving the way most likely for Rishi Sunak, former Chancellor of the Exchequer. Now, this week, I looked into the business interest that his father-in-law and wife's business, Infosys, has in Israel. Now, Infosys started, it was founded by Rishi Sunak's father-in-law in a very small room, and he built it up to be possibly the third largest company in India today. Now, this tech company has signed a memorandum of understanding with the state of Israel in 2012 to develop its shared interests. Now, we know that on a personal level, Rishi Sunak has given indication that he would strongly consider moving the British embassy to Jerusalem. It was obviously revealed fairly recently. The Conservative Friends of Israel had a pamphlet at the conference implying that the land had already been bought to move that embassy. It was something that Liz Truss was open to doing. And as I say, Rishi Sunak has said that there is a very strong case for doing that. He has also asserted that he would legislate against BDS. But where Infosys comes into this is that his wife has hundreds of millions of pounds still invested in Infosys. His father was, as I said, the founder, the chairman, and the real top dog at that company for many, many years. And he still has shares in the company and a strong interest there. Now, in the last few years, an independent director has been appointed of Infosys, who goes by the name of Yuri Levine. Now, Yuri Levine formerly was a member of Israel's military intelligence unit, 8200, who we will be speaking about a little bit later on with Alan. Infosys also has several subsidiaries within Israel, all of which employ former military personnel. And we also know that Infosys was a key seed investor in Cloud Endure, which was a tech company founded by four veterans of the Israeli military intelligence corps. Now, again, this will tie into something we will discuss later, but this company, Cloud Endure, was later purchased by Amazon, at which point Infosys gave up its interest in the company. Now, a lot of the integration of the British and the Israeli economies, which both Liz Truss and no doubt Rishi Sunak will pursue, Truss regularly spoke about how that would happen, is centered around an organization known as the UK-Israel Tech Hub. Now, it states its purpose as building the tech collaboration between the UK and Israel by facilitating partnerships between UK corporates and Israeli innovation. Now, just so we're clear, the UK-Israel Tech Hub is actually funded fully by the British taxpayer. There are four different institutions of British government that fund it. There's the Department for Business and Trade, there's the British Foreign Office, there's the British Department for Media and Culture, and there is, of course, the British Embassy. Now, it actually runs out of the British Embassy in Israel, And the chairman of this organization, the UK Israel Tech Hub, is Haim Shani. Now, he is somebody who formerly was the Director General of the Israeli Ministry of Finance. You also have the director, Keren Shurkin, of the UK Israel Tech Hub, was formerly in the Israeli military's liaison department. You also have the deputy director, Ella Kaplan, was formerly also in the Israeli military's liaison department, where she claims that she was directly behind all interactions between a specific foreign army and the Israeli military. You also have Avital Levitsky, who was in Israeli military intelligence. You also have Haida Huberman, who is the clean growth sector lead for the UK Israel Tech Hub, formerly was employed by the Israeli Ministry of Science and Technology. You have several other employees who were formerly employed by the Israeli government. So the question has to be asked here is, who exactly is funding the expansion of Israeli economic interests in this country? Because it seems to me it is the British taxpayer. And the further integration of British and Israeli military relationships and economic relationships will no doubt be pursued by the next Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak. That certainly seems to be the case. Also, we know that several weeks ago, a Palestinian photographer who worked for the New York Times in Gaza, Hussam Salim, was dismissed from the paper following the interference of a key Israeli lobby group. Now, this lobby group has quite a paradoxical name. Its name is Honest Reporting. Now, bear in mind that the New York Times, while it fired this photographer in Gaza following this intervention, it seems to have absolutely no qualms about employing Ethan Bronner, Isabel Kirshner, or David Brooks to write specifically about Palestine, while all three of those journalists have offspring who fight in the Israeli military against Palestinians. Now, Honest Reporting was the organization that contacted the New York Times and lobbied it to fire this Palestinian in Gaza working as a photographer. Honest Reporting was founded in 2006. Its founding is credited to Joe Hyams, who's actually a registered bureau speaker for the Israeli embassy in the United States. Another founder who is credited with it is Simon Ploska, who also was a part of the spokesman unit of the Israeli military and formerly worked for the largest Israel lobby group in this country, BICOM. Of course, some may remember it is the daughter lobby group of BICOM, We Believe in Israel, which has campaigned relentlessly to get my music removed from Spotify. Now, the CEO of Honest Reporting until quite recently was a gentleman by the name of Daniel Pomerantz. Now, before this, he was, you know, described himself as a civilian volunteer in the Israeli military. What we also know is that presently the CEO of Honest Reporting, Jackie Alexander, had worked for the lobby group AIPAC for around a decade and a half. We also know that the senior international connector at Honest Reporting is a man by the name of David Mercer. Now, he led the Labour Friends of Israel for over 10 years. And he claims that he has written speeches for Prime Ministers Boris Johnson, Tony Blair, and Gordon Brown. You also have Rakela Karamanson working currently as the digital media specialist at Honest Reporting. And before that, she was in the central command of the Israeli military during the Second Intifada. You even have the lead designer of Honest Reporting, Bensi Binder, who was in the Israeli military Givanti Combat Infantry Brigade. Now, Currently, as it stands, the senior editor of Honest Reporting, Gidon Ben-Zvi, was also a part of the Israeli military. And the executive director of Honest Reporting, Gil Hoffman, was in the spokesman's unit of the Israeli military. Now, actually, a video emerged of Gil Hoffman laying out the way in which Honest Reporting works with the Israeli government in what it does. And we're just going to play that video now.
Today, I went to a meeting at the foreign ministry where there were organizations that work in the pro-Israel sphere that they hosted that are non-governmental organizations. And there were 60 of us there in the room. And the government was explaining what it's doing and how they want to work better with us. It was quite impressive. We've got WhatsApp groups now that are run by the government where we share information, working together.
In other news of blacklisting and canceling, this really relentless assault on free thought, actually, we have seen the popular journalist and friend to us both, Katie Harper, dismissed from her job at The Hill, which had the reputation of being a more progressive news outlet. Now, her dismissal seems to have taken place because she put together this short segment explaining how Israel is an apartheid state. That is not a controversial viewpoint. It is put forth by many different organizations, from Beit Salim inside Palestine to, of course, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. These all are organizations who make the same claim that Katie Halper made. Now, she was duly dismissed, and I think it is worth looking a little bit deeper into what the reason around that may be and how the sort of infrastructure of power behind the Hill channel may have had a role to play in it. So, for example, it is worth noting that one of the key shareholders in Nexstar Media Group, which owns The Hill, is Pissagot Value Holdings, which, of course, is also one of the top shareholders in Israeli arms company Elbit Systems. What we also know is that the top shareholder in Nexstar is the Vanguard Group. Now, the Vanguard Group actually has a charitable endowment fund through which it has funded the ADL, well-known Israel lobby group, the Friends of the IDF, which funds the Israeli military. The Vanguard Charitable Endowment Fund also directed funds towards the Center for Security Policy, which gave us the Muslim ban. It funded the Central Fund of Israel. It funded the Israel Project. It funded the Center for American Progress. It also even funded the Investigative Project on Terrorism, which was found to have infiltrated and spied on CARE, the Muslim organization in the United States. It also funds Birthright Israel and the David Horowitz Freedom Center, and even the organization Stand With Us, which has been funded directly from the Israeli Prime Minister's office. We also know that Vanguard, being the behemoth that it is, owns 22 million shares in Lockheed Martin. That represents about 7.9% of total shares. It also owns over $3 billion worth of shares in Raytheon. It owns almost $3 billion worth of shares in Honeywell International, which is a company that claims to have hardware in almost every single military in the world, military aircraft in the world, sorry. And it also is a top shareholder in Boeing. Even if we were to look at the employees of Vanguard, we would also find business specialist Karen Galoob at Vanguard was formerly an analyst in Unit 8200 in the Israeli Military Signals Intelligence Unit. We also have someone who works in digital analytics at Vanguard, was formerly an economic intelligence analyst for the Israeli military. And also, you have a finance officer at Vanguard, also previously worked for the Israeli Ministry of Economics. But one that really caught my eye that is, I think, of key importance here is that on the board of Nexstar is a congressman by the name of Thomas McMillan. Now, formerly, he was a basketball player in the NBA. He has credited his support for Israel with being a participant in the Munich Olympics and seeing the action of Palestinian resistance groups during that time. He said, "I don't think we should succumb to terrorists. The Israelis never do, and we shouldn't either." Thomas McMillan also is one of the founders of Homeland Security Capital Corporation. This is a company which has benefited massively from the homeland security industry. And what we also know about Mr. McMillan is that he was an associate of Jeffrey Epstein. He's actually featured in the famous video of Epstein standing alongside Donald Trump. And he was obviously, his details were included in Epstein's little black book. Now, what we know about Epstein, thanks to his now deceased mentor, Stephen Hoffenberg, is that according to Hoffenberg, Epstein had been introduced by a British defense contractor by the name of Douglas Leese to Robert Maxwell. And according to Hoffenberg, Epstein had boasted about how he was going to sell Prince Andrew's secrets to Israel's intelligence agency, Mossad. We also know that, unfortunately, Mr. Hoffenberg, age 77, died a few months ago. It's believed that he wasn't discovered until 7 days after he had died. So there are serious question marks around the decision to dismiss Katie Halper, and we really haven't seen any statement from The Hill or Nexstar clearing this up and clarifying exactly how something like this could have happened. We do also know that Nexstar hired as the deputy managing editor of News Nation, one of its subsidiaries, a gentleman who previously had been the Israeli consulate general in New York. Actually, he'd been the media director of the Israeli consulate in New York. Goes by the name of Jake Novak. And actually, just 6 days before he had been hired in that position by Nexstar, he had given a presentation at an Israeli university titled Defending Israel Against Media Bias, How to Fight News Media and Social Media Bias Against Israel. The best defense is a good offense. So here we see some of the infrastructure around The Hill, and possibly it could have been part of the reason that Katie Halper was fired from her job. So now I'd like to welcome Alan to the show. It's great to have you back, Alan. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's good to be with you.
Thank you. And we do know recently in Britain that the Israel lobby has set its sights on the BBC in quite a major way. We have seen several main Israel lobby groups, from the Board of Deputies to the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism to other organizations, publish this letter signed by many people saying that the BBC needs to address its coverage of Israel. It needs to improve its coverage of Israel and make it more essentially pro-Israeli is what's being asked in this letter. Now, Alan, you have done some really interesting research into the BBC and its relationship with the British establishment. One of the fascinating statistics that you point out in your work is you mention that between 2018 and 2022, the number of people in Britain that say they trust the coverage of the BBC dropped from 75% to about 55%. Can you explain why that might be, Anna?
Well, I mean, first of all, this is happening all over the West. As society starts to disintegrate, as people's living standards continue to either flatline or even drop in a lot of circumstances, we're still seeing the same old media picture whereby they essentially say everything is fine. There's no problems to be worried about. And so ultimately, we're seeing a sort of distrust of all sorts of forms of authority, whether it's political parties, religious groups, scientists, anything really all over the world. And this is really a sort of sign of the deep malaise society is in. Now, the BBC did have a very good reputation for many decades, but I think in recent years, a lot of political questions that have arisen in the UK, such as the Brexit referendum, or the question of Scottish independence, or political elections between Labour and the Conservatives, have really brought the BBC and media more generally to the fore for a lot of people who used to perhaps not really think too much about it. If you're on the wrong side of one of these blatant media campaigns to push a certain agenda, you start realizing how the media functions, and your trust in those institutions is very often forever irreparably damaged. Furthermore, we've seen people turn towards also social media and alternative media, which are really doing a great job in holding up a mirror to establishment media such as the BBC and pointing out its flaws, its fundamental biases, and what its agenda is. And so ultimately, when I see a stat like 55% of people still trust the coverage of the BBC, I think that's 55% too many. We shouldn't be trusting media at all. Rather, we should be critically evaluating everything we consume, even alternative media. But ultimately, we shouldn't have trusted the BBC in the first place.
Well said. And Alan, you mention in your piece a revolving door between the BBC and NATO. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, sure. So I think the best way of answering that question is to just give a few examples of what I mean, whereby people go straight from the BBC into quite high and senior jobs in NATO, which isn't really something that should be happening in a democratic country. For instance, between 2007 and 2008, the longtime BBC producer and news presenter Victoria Cook was simultaneously also collecting a paycheck from NATO, working as a media trainer and a journalist for them. Another one you could have a look at is Mark Laity. He left his position as the BBC's defence correspondent to immediately become the deputy spokesman to the NATO Secretary General, who was Lord Robertson at the time, a British man. So we have a situation where somebody is supposed to be critically scrutinising an organisation and an individual within NATO, and then suddenly becomes his PR man. That's not something that should really be happening, but it's happening all too often. Some travel in the other way. In fact, Terence Sack, for instance, left his job as an intelligence and security analyst at the UK Ministry of Defence in 2017, and he became an information security specialist at the BBC. Perhaps most worrying, though, is that there are a lot of people who openly, at least on their social media profile, identify themselves as working in NATO psychological operations or PSYOPs. And at the same time as that, we're working for the BBC. So a couple of examples I found were Suleiman Ratmanich, who worked for the BBC World Service between 2005 and 2014. Between 1994 and 2014. And over a similar period of time, he was also working as a video editor for NATO. In his own words, and I quote, editing short PSYOPs clips. That those clips were aimed at the Afghan population. This seems to happen a lot when the United Kingdom goes to war, because about 20 years ago, the UK was bombing Yugoslavia. And it was also a situation for Bojan Lazic, who at the same time as working as a NATO psychological operations specialist, he was also working for the BBC. And so ultimately we see this close amalgamation of a state broadcaster and the British state military's apparatus itself. Perhaps we shouldn't be so surprised about this, but it is shocking nonetheless.
Absolutely. And I mean, you also mention in your brilliant piece, which I recommend everybody check out, the links between the BBC as it currently stands and the Conservative Party. Could you tell me a bit about that, please?
Yeah, there's a lot of people who say the BBC has this left-wing bias, and it's become almost a meme among Conservatives to say that. But when you actually look at who is making the decisions in the BBC and what its output is, the absolute opposite starts to come to mind. So, for instance, the BBC's chairman right now, Richard Sharp, it was an advisor to many senior Conservatives, including Rishi Sunak, who might well be prime minister by the time people are listening to this. And he was also an advisor to former Prime Minister Boris Johnson as well, and one of the party's largest benefactors, donating around $500,000 to the party. Another person we could have a look at is Robbie Gibb, who was the head of political programming. He is the brother of Tory MP and former cabinet minister Nick Gibb. And he left the BBC in 2017 to become director of communications for the Conservative Party, and specifically the prime minister at the time, Theresa May. So there's another link to the point where this person is really shaping political commentary on the BBC and deciding what gets said, what doesn't get said, who gets commissioned and who gets rejected. And at the same time, he's almost openly an agent of the Conservative Party, which is what a lot of senior BBC journalists were saying and complaining about at the time. Many of the BBC's most influential and biggest names have also similar connections to Conservative Party. For instance, Tim Davie, the former Director General of the BBC, was deputy chairman of the Hammersmith and Fulham Conservative Party, and even stood for elections twice as a Conservative Party representative. The former political editor of the BBC, Nick Robinson, who currently hosts the flagship Today programme, was the chairman of the National Young Conservatives and the president of the Oxford University Conservative Association in his youth. And of course, yeah, we can go down the list, but it just person after person after person have deep connections, deep links to the Conservative Party. And that is ultimately one of the reasons why the BBC's outlook is so pro-Tory, so pro-Conservative, and why they really are refusing to challenge the Tory government, even as it leads the country towards the brink of disaster.
And could you point out, Alan, what the connections are not only between the BBC and the MI5, but also the BBC and the British military? Could you point out some of that for us, please?
Yeah, I mean, this connection to the Conservative Party is not reciprocated on the left. You won't find far left figures getting cushy jobs in the BBC. In fact, the BBC, since almost its very existence, the start of its existence, at least in the post-war era, has been working closely with MI5, allowing the latter, the British Secret Service, to vet pretty much all candidates for important positions within their organization to make sure that people whose views are a little bit too anti-war or a little bit too left-wing simply will not get a job. Now, we know for certain that this policy was enacted throughout the Cold War, but there's very good reason to believe this is still going on to this day. Very recently, some BBC journalists actually asked the corporation themselves, the one that they work for, the BBC, whether this policy of vetting all staff for important positions was still going on. Did they still have this relationship with MI5? And the BBC refused to answer their question on national security grounds, which is about as close to a yes as I think you're likely to get. And so ultimately, the BBC has had this very close relationship with the British state for a long, long time. In fact, even when you go back to its very nascent days in the 1920s, Lord Reith, who is the leader of the BBC at the time, pledged his support to the Conservative government to put down the general strike of 1926. He was broadcasting round-the-clock propaganda, demonizing the strikers and saying that, you know, we were going to have another USSR if they were allowed to win. And he ultimately said that if France in 1787 had a BBC, there would never have been a French Revolution. So he was taking credit for actually stymieing social change and working closely with the British military and the British establishment to make sure that that change didn't come about.
And also, I think it's important that people understand when we talk about MI5 vetting, is that evidence was found showing that even people that, it's not just people that were on screen, it's not just people that were on air, people that worked in wardrobes in terms of dressing people, people that worked in makeup were being vetted by the MI5. Bear in mind, this whole time, Jimmy Savile is a superstar at the BBC and has since been accused of a litany of sexual assaults. Are we to believe that the MI5 was able to know if somebody had a relative who was in the Socialist Workers' Party, but yet they wouldn't have known what Jimmy Savile was doing? I mean, you know, I hate to be or sound conspiratorial about it, but it seems quite strange, unfortunately. The other question I wanted to ask, Alan, did you come across anyone who simultaneously works for the British military and works for the BBC? Is that something that you found, just anecdotally?
There was one person I could talk about, one of them being Kashuru Cooper. According to Cooper's social media profile, he continues to be a commissioned British Army officer right now. He's held that position for 20 years, I believe. Now, Cooper has recently been appointed the head of assurance at the BBC. We're not really quite sure what that job entails, but generally, people who are in assurance are doing quality control, checking things. We don't really know what that means in the BBC context, but in the context that we've just been talking about in terms of vetting and making sure, you know, messages are on point, I do find that quite hair-raising.
And so we have quite an interesting picture here of an institution which is followed by millions upon millions of people across the world, relied upon for their window to understanding so many things happening around them. Myself, on a personal level, I can see the fingerprints of the BBC on a lot of my assumptions, actually, about the world when I was in my teen years. It was almost a friendly companion in life, whether it was Radio 5 Live or whether to listen to the football, whether it was Match of the Day. You know, so there's a kind of intimacy that the BBC has certainly enjoyed and still does enjoy with many different people across the world. The question would then be, when you have this sort of insurgent political movement, which was Corbynism, which sweeps up and encourages and broadens political participation, or at least so we thought, in the country, you have around 600,000 people in the Labour Party almost overnight. You know, several hundred thousand people are added to this party. What was the response of the BBC to Jeremy Corbyn and the movement that he represented?
Well, they were very angry to see it happen. I think media in general went on the offensive, not even just from day one, but from minute one, portraying Corbyn as all sorts of ludicrous, monstrous things, from a terrorist sympathizer to, like somebody who was secretly part of the IRA or had been doing deals with Eastern European communist regimes. There was a days-long scandal in the United Kingdom during the November 11th memorial, the memorial that Corbyn was at, because he didn't bow quite deeply enough. It was called Bowgate in the media. There was also another one called Coatgate around the same time, when media started absolutely condemning him for wearing a coat that was not considered expensive or formal enough for the occasion. Some of the headlines that came out of the media at that time really have to be seen to be believed, because people from outside the United Kingdom look at these things and think they just must be a joke, that somebody's doctored them. But some of my favorites include, for instance, from The Telegraph, a headline called, "A tie is a mark of ambition. Jeremy Corbyn alarmed me by wearing one as it showed he craved power." Or another fantastic headline was, "Teenage Corbyn squashed my sister's baby rabbit with his pogo stick." The media went absolutely wild. Like, even things like Jeremy Corbyn's hat was criticized for looking like Lenin's hat, and that was insinuating that he was really a violent revolutionary going to destroy everything and, you know, rip up your lawns and, you know, kick down your house or whatever. His bicycle was described as a Chairman Mao style bicycle. And some of the attacks on him were not just, flippant, but actually extremely serious. So, for instance, just days after a Labour MP was actually murdered in the street by a right wing, seriously deranged man, her name was Jo Cox, just days after her murder, the Daily Mail published an article called "Labour Must Kill the Vampire Jezza." And this really took on extremely serious overtone, when in fact a terrorist by the name of Darren Osborne actually drove down to London and was searching for Jeremy Corbyn, trying to kill him. He couldn't find him in the end, but in the end, he actually took his anger out on a mosque in North London, killing many people. And so ultimately, there was this utter hysteria that was built up over the few years that Jeremy Corbyn was leader of the Labour Party. Now, the BBC itself, it was part of this. It wasn't the worst offender, perhaps, but because of its size and influence, it was perhaps the most important. And ultimately, the BBC itself found in its own commissions that its political editor, Laura Kunzberg, broke impartiality laws when discussing Corbyn and when covering him. There's been plenty of good academic research on this. One from Justin Schlossberg found that the media totally ridiculed and attacked him, misrepresented his words at all times. It even has an entire section of the paper called Delegitimization Through Ridicule, Scorn, and Personal Attacks. Ultimately, though, I think the biggest attack on Corbyn, the one that really sustained for many, many months and really bit into the British public's consciousness in a way that other ones didn't, was the question of anti-Semitism. And certainly the BBC was in the lead in this. Corbyn was constantly, overwhelmingly presented as this secret Jew hater who was on a mission to, you know, rid the world and kill everybody. It was incredible. In the run-up to the election in 2019, in the 3 months preceding that, one historian found that there had been 1,450 articles in national newspapers in the UK linking Corbyn to anti-Semitism. And so ultimately, the BBC was a crucial part in the demonization campaign against Corbyn. And also, let's not forget the hundreds of thousands of people who were inspired enough to join the Labour Party and the millions of people who heard Corbyn's voice, his calls for a more fair, equitable society. And that, going back to the first question that you asked me, is one of the many, many reasons that so many people, especially young people who Corbyn's message really resonated with, do not trust the BBC anymore.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And one of the key points at which the BBC was particularly violent against Corbyn and the rest of us was the Panorama episode looking at anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, John Ware's documentary. And it was revealed fairly recently by the Al Jazeera Labour Files that a gentleman featured in there by the name of Ben Westerman, or Waterman, I forget his exact second name, was found to not be telling the truth about a Labour Party member, smearing this Labour Party member. Also, you had featuring Izzy Lenger in the documentary, somebody who had previously been trained by the Israeli military. Of course, that wasn't mentioned in the documentary. You had Ella Rose in the documentary, who, of course, was a former employee of the Israeli embassy. What we also know is that the BBC previously employed a gentleman by the name of Eli Ovitz, who claims to have worked as an assistant producer for the BBC, simultaneous to him working as a spokesman for the Israeli military. So there are major, major questions about impartiality at the BBC. And in a way, this leads us on to our next question, which is some great research, which I have had the privilege to hear about from you. Could you just tell me about Unit 8200 in the Israeli military? What is it?
Sure. So it's the Israeli military's largest unit. It is essentially Israel's version of the NSA. It is a cyber and intelligence unit dedicated to, you know, furthering the goals of the Israeli government. And it's really the centerpiece of the Israeli high-tech industry as well. It trains thousands of young Israelis, and these people generally don't stay in Unit 8200 very long, maybe 3 years. They do their national service, and then they go out into the tech world and try to find much better paying jobs. The reason 8200 is so controversial, though, is that it is one of the cornerstones of the surveillance and spying operation that Israel is carrying out against its domestic Palestinian operation. Unlike Jewish citizens, Arab citizens are not required to serve in the IDF. In fact, they're very often strongly dissuaded from doing so. And Unit 8200 has really been at the forefront of trying to blackmail and extort the Palestinian population under Israeli control through all the sort of data that they've been able to collect on people. So we know, for instance, because multiple times people have come out, ex-Unit 8200 whistleblowers, dozens of them, in fact, and have really testified to the disgraceful treatment of the local population at the hands of Unit 8200, treating them as criminals, not differentiating between people using violence and people just going about their ordinary day. We know that Unit 8200 compiles lists and dossiers on huge numbers of Palestinians, including things like their medical history, their sexual orientation, whether they've had affairs, anything like that, and then uses that information to extort or blackmail these people into silence or in any way complying with what they want from them. On the world stage, though, Unit 8200 is notorious as well, because so many people from its alumni have been involved in some of the most outrageous and controversial spying operations and hacking dumps that we've seen. Perhaps the most well-known is the Pegasus scandal, whereby this organization, the NSO, which was started almost certainly by Unit 8200 alumni, they created this piece of software called Pegasus, which could be used to hack the phones and other electronic devices of notable people, including journalists and politicians. We know that around 50,000 people worldwide were being spied upon using this technology, which this company NSO was selling to some of the most vicious, brutal authoritarian regimes all around the world, including Saudi Arabia, of course. We can put two and two together, and we're pretty sure that the Saudi government was actually using this Pegasus software to track the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi just in the days and even hours before they assassinated him by cutting him up with cleavers. And so ultimately, we do have this situation where Unit 8200 is this sort of intellectual brain hub from whence a lot of these semi-private companies come out and then do a lot of Israel's dirtiest work behind the scenes. And that really suits the Israeli government and the Israeli military, because they have some form of plausible deniability if this is a technically private Israeli tech company spying on foreign dignitaries like France's Emmanuel Macron, for instance, the former president of France, or dozens of Mexican journalists, or a company compiling a list of secret homosexuals in Indonesia for blackmail purposes. That's the sort of stuff that the Israeli government doesn't want their hands on. But when it's a private tech company doing this, that's great for them because they can reap the benefits, but they don't have to face any of the consequences.
Wow. What's the connection between Unit 8200 and big tech companies like Google, Facebook, Twitter, and others?
Yeah, so most of what I've been talking about for the last few minutes is pretty much common knowledge, both in Israeli society and in the tech industry more generally. But what I found in that investigation was that I found literally hundreds of former Unit 8200 veterans in some of the largest big tech and social media companies worldwide. And this included around 99 in Google, more than 160 in Microsoft, more than 50 in Amazon, and many more dozens in other big tech companies like Instagram or TikTok. Now, I'm not some sort of tech wizard. This was done simply by going to various social media databases, especially LinkedIn, and then looking for current employees of big tech firms and seeing whether they mentioned their past experience in Unit 8200. That I was able to find hundreds of people that easily is very worrying, because it is actually against Israeli law for anybody to publicly identify themselves as having belonged to Unit 8200. And so these people on LinkedIn and other social media sites are actually risking prosecution by identifying themselves with the past. And so the fact that I was able to so easily find hundreds of people like this really suggests that this problem is absolutely enormous. I'll give you some specific examples of where Unit 8200 people often end up. Gavriel Goidel was between 2010 and 2016 head of learning at Unit 8200. He was recently appointed head of strategy and operations at Google. Another Google employee we could talk about is Jonathan Cohen. Between 2000 and 2003, he was a team leader at Unit 8200. But since then, he spent more than 13 years working at Google in various senior positions. He's currently head of insights, data, and measurement at Google. But it's not just Google. It's pretty much any big tech company you can think of. For instance, the head of data science at Meta, which is the official name for Facebook, is Eyal Klein. And between 2007 and 2013, he was a captain in Unit 8200. Or we could have a look at Eilert Steinitz, who for a long time was in Unit 8200 in the 1990s. And then between 2018 and 2020, he was head of global strategic alliances at Microsoft. And so ultimately, we have hundreds of examples of this. But even though these people are very high up, perhaps the most surprising that I found were the people who were directly plucked from Unit 8200 and then went straight into jobs into these big tech firms, mostly in the United States and in Western Europe. I found that very surprising, considering that we know that Unit 8200's strategy is to try and burrow into a lot of these big tech companies and exploit their weaknesses so that they can spy on people worldwide. Now, I'm sure other big big bad organizations like the FSB, which is the Russian successor to the KGB, are doing this as well. But the difference is that when you look for former KGB or FSB agents that work at big tech, you'll find none, because Google and Microsoft and Amazon are not hiring these Russian tech wizards who used to, you know, do Putin's bidding. But they are doing it with Israel, and they are doing it with other Western governments. And that should really worry us all, considering that, you know, social media has become so important, and all of our data, financial, medical, whatever, is now online. And we're trusting these big companies with so much of our information, our lives, in fact. And when you look at who they're starting to employ, I think that really raises a lot of deep, deep questions that we are only now beginning to even talk about, even in small circles like ours.
Absolutely. And on a sort of anecdotal basis, I was told by a Google employee in 2021 at the beginning of it, so quite a long time before the situation in Ukraine became as terrible as it is now, that Google would not hire Google would not hire anyone who was Russian. So, of course, this was just an anecdotal comment, and you know, but it's very interesting. And you know, as you've pointed out here, you know, these are massive double standards. You would not see this with other particular nations, especially ones involved in alleged war crimes and carrying out occupation of different places, whether it's Syria or Palestine. Thank you so much for joining us today, Alan. As always, it has been a really enlightening conversation, and I hope that everybody can support Alan in the vital work that he does for Mint Press and for all of us. Thank you for joining us today on The Watchdog. See you next time.